For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we're going to be looking at Hebrews 11, verse 23 through 28. We're going to be studying Moses' faith. Again, just to sort of give us a little bit of context, you know, this chapter is really all about faith. In Hebrews 11, verse 1, we're told, "Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see." So we've mentioned this throughout the last few weeks, how biblical faith is not the same as the type of faith that we tend to think of in our culture, where you just have, wishful thinking, where you sort of hope that something is going to happen. You have faith in something despite the fact that the evidence suggests otherwise. But there's actually a certainty in biblical faith where it's grounded in something objective. And this theme that comes up really throughout all of chapter 11 is that faith is something that, though it's certain, it's something that we cannot see. And so whenever God speaks and gives us promises, often the fulfillment of those promises are far off and they're unseen to us in the moment. And so biblical faith reaches out, leans out to try to grab on to these promises that God gives us. All right, so let's dive into Hebrews 11, verse 23. We're told, "By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict." So to sort of fast forward us through the narrative, remember last week we studied Joseph, and he got Israel and his 12 sons, or his 11 sons, into Egypt and set them up with this incredibly fertile land in Goshen. And because of the Egyptians' hatred toward people with hair and animals, they basically segregated the Israelites to this incredibly fertile land where they grew and multiplied. And so over 300 years of multiplying and growing from a small family into hundreds of thousands of people into this nation, the current Pharaoh during Moses' day felt threatened by them. And so as a result, talked to some of his advisors, and they said, "Let's try to subjugate the Israelites, because otherwise they may rise up against us and try to take over." And so they put him into forced labor. They enslave them. And every time the Pharaoh tried to oppress the Hebrew people, it just seemed like they kept multiplying and growing even more. And so finally he said, "Why don't we do this?" Whenever he calls in these two midwives, he says, "Okay, I want you to basically kill every Hebrew boy that's born." And so when this edict was put out, we're told, "By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw he was no ordinary child." Now let's look at the actual account in Exodus 1, verse 15 and 16, where the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shipra and Puah, certainly there must have been way more midwives than these two. They probably were the ones who were managing the other midwives, because there were hundreds of thousands of Hebrews. "When you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe, if it's a boy, kill him, but if it's a girl, let her live." The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women, you don't understand, are unlike Egyptian women, for they're vigorous. And they give birth before the midwives even return." And they're like, "You got to see this happen. I mean, these women, they're vigorous, you know." Pharaoh's like, "Pass. I don't want to see that. I believe you." Well, then Pharaoh commanded the midwives to throw every male child into the Nile. He said, "Okay, if we can't get them at birth, why don't we just take every child that's born and throw them into the Nile?" You know, when Moses was born, we see that his parents recognized that he was extraordinary. And, you know, this must have been a revelation from God, where God showed them that he was actually going to do something special in his plan of rescuing the Hebrew people. So it wasn't just that they looked at him and they're like, oh, he's really special, because every single parent who has a child thinks their kid's special. And so this must have been revealed from God. And so Moses' parents hatch a plan. They're like, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to take a basket. We're going to cover it in tar and pitch. And then we're going to put it right there in the reeds on the bank of the Nile. And we're going to make sure that Moses' older sister, Miriam, is standing right there. And so at that time, we read in verse 5, Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe. Well, 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 that's coincidental. And her attendants were walking along the river bank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to go and get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and so she felt sorry for him. This is one of those Hebrew babies, she said. And so she's automatically just taken with this baby. She must have recognized that this baby was special. At that point, enter stage right Miriam. Then his sister, Moses' sister, asked Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and see one of the Hebrew women to nurse this baby for you? She said, yes, she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you. So the woman took the baby and nursed him. Wow. Worked out pretty well, didn't it? You know, not only did Moses' mother rescue her own child, she was able to actually nurse him, raise him, and she was getting paid for it. Now, it seems like they executed their plan perfectly. And I remember reading this as a young Christian and thinking, okay, this must have been like Moses' mother was like distraught about this edict, so she got Moses into a basket, covered it with, you know, tar and pitch, and just sort of sent him into the mouth of the, you know, the mighty Nile River or something like that. Being like, yeah, Godspeed. Hope this works out. But that's not the way it went down. You know, she probably scoped out where Pharaoh's daughter would be bathing. She had Miriam there ready when Pharaoh's daughter found Moses. And it seems like they actually had hatched this plan. It was something that they had thought about in conjunction with God's promise to deliver Moses and his people through him. You know, I think this points to the fact that biblical faith doesn't imply passivity. You know, she didn't just let go and let God. She actually had a plan. And this is one of the things that you see in biblical faith, is that on the one hand, we're called on to trust God, but we also have our part to play as well. According to God, human agency really does matter. And so we have this incredible privilege and opportunity to work side by side with God, where we take steps of faith and he empowers us as we do that. So what does this story tell us about faith? I think the first thing is that Moses' parents weren't commended for trying to save their baby. I mean, after all, it's a parental instinct to try to save your kid if it's about to die or if it's in danger. That's not what they were being commended for. It's that God's promise led Moses' parents to grasp on to what was unseen. God revealed to them that he was going to be special, that he was going to be used in a particular way. They knew that the king's edict was to try to wipe out all of the firstborn males. And so what they decided to do was come up with a plan. It was risky, but they trusted that God was going to come through. And so they grasped on to what they could not see, trusting in God's promises. You know, really what this comes down to is that Moses' parents feared God more than they feared men. Hebrews tells us that they were not afraid of the king's edict. That's why they were commended. It wasn't that they tried to save their kid. It was their reason, their basis for trying to save him. It was that they didn't fear the king. They feared God more. They knew that they needed to listen to God instead of listening to the king. And I think this points to the fact that you're either seeking the approval of God or you're seeking the approval of people. You really can't have it both ways. You know, many of us in this room struggle with wanting to please the people around us. We're so consumed with, you know, managing people's expectations of us. We're always trying to predict what we think people want from us. And when we're beholden to people and what they think of us, it will ultimately lead to betrayal. That we're going to come into situations where we either are going to listen to God and what he has to say for us, or we're going to listen to what we think people want from us. And some of us are struggling with this right now. You know, some of us are under incredible pressure from our family. Maybe some of our close friends who are constantly mocking us and saying, why are you wasting your time doing this God thing? And if their opinion matters to you more than God's, then eventually you're going to end up betraying God. Think about what Paul says in Galatians 1:10. He says, am I now trying to win the approval of men or of God? Or am I trying to please men? If I were still trying to please men, I would not be a servant of Christ. Notice the conflict between those two things. If I were trying to please people, I would not be a servant of Christ. So it implies that in the long run, you're either a servant of Christ or you're somebody who's going to try to please people. And you know, God's going to slowly root that out in your life. But I think you need to be able to take the steps necessary that God calls you to see and gain victory in that area of your life. Okay, moving on to verses 24 through 26 in Hebrews 11. The author of Hebrews says, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his future reward. Again, let's look back to the Exodus narrative to kind of get a more complete picture of this story. Starting in Exodus 2, verse 11, it came about in those days when Moses had grown up that when he went out to his brethren and looked how hard their labors were. So Moses, as you know, he's 40 years old at this time, and he looked out and he saw the hard labor that faced his brethren, his people. And so, you know, he's sitting there in the lap of luxury in the palace, enjoyed all of these benefits that none of his Hebrew compatriots had, and he looked at them and saw the brutality, the suffering that they were experiencing, and he felt compassion for them. We're told, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. And so he looked this way, and then he looked that way, and saw that no one was around, and then he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. He was a man of principle. You could tell Moses had a strong moral compass. And so that's what led him to strike down this Egyptian, because he saw this Egyptian mistreating one of his people. Now, he knew that this was wrong, because we're told that he looked this way and that way. You know, when you're looking around, before you do something that indicates that you know that what you're about to do is wrong. And so Moses understood that what he was doing here was morally wrong. You know, Moses' strong sense of justice really led him to take matters into his own hands. And this is characteristic of Moses' early life, that he saw the right thing to do, but he was trusting in himself to get it done. And that's typical, I think, for many believers in God who are trying to follow him. A lot of times we have that sense that we should do this and it's right, but often we're trusting in ourselves. And that's the same thing that Moses fell into. Well, when Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled into the land of Midian. And so he knew that this was a sort of one-way street, that once he decided to strike down this Egyptian, life would change for him, that he would never be accepted into Pharaoh's court, that in fact, Pharaoh himself would probably try to hunt him down and kill him. Now, it's important for us to understand when we read Hebrews 11, verse 24 through 26, that the author of Hebrews isn't praising Moses for murdering the Egyptian. That's not really the point of him commending Moses for his faith. He's praising Moses for choosing to throw in with God's people. That he didn't just sit there in the comforts of his palace, in the lap of luxury, and just stand there and watch his people be oppressed day after day. Instead, he decided to be with them, to help them out. And so again, what does this story tell us about faith? I think, first of all, Moses was looking ahead to the unseen reward that God would give him. That's really, I think, what he's doing here is, and that's indicated by the book of Hebrews, that he was looking toward this future reward that he would get from God. You know, and this future reward that he was looking forward to really led him to do three things. The first thing is that he rejected the riches of Egypt to obtain true riches. We get this from Hebrews 11, verse 26. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. We really have to try to wrap our minds around what situation Moses was in. You know, he was related to the most powerful man on earth. And so as a result, he lived a life of privilege. He was likely incredibly wealthy. He probably had, luxury items filling this palace that he had. And he decided to give all of that up. And, you know, I think that today, when you look at our culture, you know, living for material things, for money and possessions, is like the ultimate thing. People squander their entire lives to amass as much money and to have as many possessions as they possibly can as the basis and purpose for their lives. And yet you have to ask yourself, to what end? After all, once we die, we can't take any of that wealth with us. And so Moses must have realized that all of these riches that I have here, that I'm enjoying here in Egypt, all of that's going to pass away. Instead, I need to focus on the true reward that I can have by following God and his purpose for my life. And you know, that's why around here we really emphasize devoting yourself to the things that are going to endure eternally. Because, you know, all of the temporary stuff, all of the material possessions that we're desperately trying to grasp onto, all of that's going to pass away once we're dead. But the true riches of following God, investing in people, investing in people's eternal destinies, investing in our personal relationship with God, those are things that we're going to be able to take with us. Those are going to be the true rewards of heaven. And so that's one of the things that Moses must have realized. Secondly, this led him to reject the fleeting pleasures of sin to be mistreated alongside his people. We're told in Hebrews 11:25, he chose to be mistreated with his people rather than enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. You know, with this privilege, with this money, and probably his fame, he probably could have had everything you could want. You know, the choicest food, the best wine. I'm sure that his fame probably allowed him to have any woman he wanted in the kingdom. And so he could have lived a life of complete sensuality and pleasure. And yet he realized that all of that is fleeting. You know, again, you see many people in our culture today living their lives for pleasurable experiences. I mean, if you don't have God in your life, what else would you be doing? I mean, that makes sense, right? If there is no hope, then we might as well enjoy ourselves in this short period of time that we have here on earth. And yet, if God does exist, that really changes everything, doesn't it? If God exists, it implies that this life is only something temporary, that there's more out there. And so, you know, one of the things that God says is that in this life, we can set aside living for pleasure in order to really live a life of purpose and meaning. Now, we have to qualify this by pointing out that God is not anti-pleasure. You know, you hear that a lot of times in our culture, you know, man, the God of the Bible, he's just always just trying to rob us of like having fun. And you think about Christians and you think that they're all, you know, lame, they're boring, they never want to have fun. And yet, God, he's the one who created pleasure. He's the one who created our nerve endings to enjoy pleasure. So God's not anti-pleasure. The problem that he has with this life that is lived for pleasure, though, is that when you take something that's good, like pleasurable experiences, and you elevate it to something that is ultimate in life, it effectively replaces him in our hearts. And so that's one of the things that God is against, is he wants to make sure that he is top priority in our lives. Because he knows that if we try to live our lives on these things like pleasure, that ultimately that is going to, you know, it's going to take us out. That it's not going to ultimately fulfill us. And so that's one of the reasons why we argue that you shouldn't live solely for pleasure, that it's a futile endeavor to do that. Not to mention the fact that, you know, people who live for pleasure, a lot of times the thrill and excitement of having that pleasurable experience, chasing after that new sexual experience, that new high, partying, a lot of times it just drops off. And you find yourself addicted, wanting more, and yet feeling like, you know what, this is just not really that satisfying. And so I think that one of the reasons why God says that we shouldn't live our lives for pleasure is that ultimately it can end up enslaving us. Far from being freedom to do whatever we want, it actually becomes slavery. Now, some people might say, well, what's wrong with living in luxury and, you know, being comfortable in your home and your palace? But anyway, you know, some people might say that. Well, why is it wrong to do that? I mean, is it sin? And the answer is, it is sin when you watch all the people around you suffering and in need. And you're living in complete comfort and luxury doing nothing. Yes, that's wrong. Yes, that's sin, according to the Bible. You know, James 4, verse 17 says, if anyone knows what he ought to do and does not do it, it's sin. And so, according to God, sin is not just when you do something wrong, it's when you fail to do what you know is right. Thirdly, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And so he threw off this title that gave him legitimacy, that gave him status. And, you know, One route that he could have probably taken is he might have said to himself, you know what, maybe what I should do is I should try to ascend to the throne or maybe to a prominent place in Pharaoh's court, and then maybe I can influence him to relax and not be so hard on the on my people. Or he could have said, you know, it's been this way for a number of years now. I'm not sure. I mean, who am I? How am I going to really change anything? And so he might have just resigned himself to do nothing and just live in comfort and not have to lift a finger. And yet, if Moses would have done that, what would have happened? Nothing. We would have never remembered Moses. He would have disappeared off the screen of history. And yet today, even though Moses probably looked totally foolish to his close family and friends, you know, I'm sure they were probably sitting there when he went off to be with his people. They're probably thinking to themselves, man, what a waste. He could have been great. He could have been something. And he wasted his time following after this foreign god. And for what? He's got nothing. Now Pharaoh wants to kill him. Now, things look a little bit different these days, don't they, from our perspective? Let me ask you a question. Who is the Pharaoh of Moses' day? Exactly. We don't know. And yet Moses is maybe one of the most famous figures in all of history. And so, you know, things look different thousands of years later, and certainly things are going to look pretty different even 1,000 years from now. In the final estimation, when people are looking at us and saying, you know, why are you wasting your time? You're missing out on important opportunities. You have this incredible privilege that other people would die to have, and you're throwing it away to follow this god. Thousands of years from now, things are going to look really different. And I doubt if any of us are going to be thinking to ourselves, I really regret sacrificing that for God, if you could even call that a sacrifice. So then Moses flees to Midian, to the Sinai Peninsula, and he disappears for about 40 years. He ends up becoming a sheep herder. And one day, you know, as he's walking around, milling around with his flock, he looks over and he sees that there's this bush and it's on fire. He's like, oh, man, crazy bush on fire. And so as he's walking, he looks back and he sees that this bush is still burning when it should have been consumed. And so he walks over to take a closer look. And as he gets around the perimeter of this bush, it must have been a big bush, or at least the fire was, a voice from heaven calls out and says, Moses, you're stepping on holy ground. Take your shoes off. Apparently God was Asian. And so he reveals to Moses, he says, you know what? I'm going to do something great through you. And he said, I'm going to rescue you. I'm going to rescue you and your people from Egypt. I'm going to have you lead the Israelites out of Egypt, away from Pharaoh. And Moses was just like, I tried that already, God. And he said, it's different this time. You know, you spent 40 years of your first the first 40 years of your life trying to act like you were somebody, and it took you 40 more years here in Midian to realize you're nobody. And that's exactly where I want you to be, because you need to realize that the only way that you're going to save this people is through me and my power. And so he goes into Pharaoh's court as God told him to, and he demands, he says, I'll let my people go. And Pharaoh says no, which was then followed by a plague. Again, he steps into Pharaoh's court. He says, no, I'm serious. You need to let my people go. And Pharaoh's like, no. And then another plague hits Egypt. This happens 8 times. And finally, he goes in and he's like, no, seriously, God says, let my people go. And we're told that by faith, Moses left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. And so that last time, we're told in Exodus 10, verse 20 and 29, he says, get out of my sight. Make sure you don't appear before me again. The day that you see my face, you will die. And Moses said, just as you say, I will never appear before you again. And so Moses, in an act of defiance, says, you know what? I don't care if you're angry at me. I'm going to be loyal to God no matter what. And so what does this tell us about faith? I think the first thing is that Moses didn't fear Pharaoh because he saw God. You know, that event where he saw the burning bush and God spoke to him and revealed his name, his character to Moses, was life transforming. He knew that there was nothing to fear, no person to fear, even the most powerful man on earth, because he knew God. Like his parents, Moses feared God more than he feared people. The most powerful man at that. And so then we're told that God said, okay, this last plague that I'm going to send, I'm going to take out all of the firstborn children. The author of Hebrews tells us in Hebrews 11, verse 28, by faith, Moses kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. And so again, let's try to fill out this account a little bit more by looking at Exodus. In Exodus 12, verse 3, God says, speak to the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, they are each one to take a lamb for themselves according to their father's households, a lamb for each household. So God says to Moses, he says, in this final plague, I'm going to extract the Hebrews out of Egypt. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to send judgment upon Egypt and take all of the firstborn children unless they follow my command here. He says, now if the household is too small for the lamb, then he and his neighbor are nearest to his house are to take one according to the number of the persons in them, according to what each man should eat. You are to divide the lamb. He says, your lamb shall be an unblemished male, a year old, and you may take it from the sheep or from the goats. And so he specifies, you guys are going to have this meal, and I want you to take an unblemished male lamb. And we find out later on in the New Testament that this actually has significance, that this unblemished male lamb was really typical or symbolic of God's sacrifice that he would send through his son, Jesus Christ. This idea of being unblemished sort of symbolized the idea of being innocent, being blameless, which we're taught in the Bible that Jesus was perfect in every way. And we also see that he fulfills this symbolism of being a lamb too, the sacrificial animal. When John the Baptist sees Jesus for the very first time, or for the first time in his ministry, he says in John 1:29, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. And so Jesus literally was God's perfect sacrifice that he sent for us. And we're also told that it should be according to what each man or person should eat. And so apparently they needed to make sure that the lamb that they had was going to be big enough for the entire household so that every person had a portion to eat. And this, again, I think is symbolic of the fact that Jesus' sacrifice would be enough for all people. That whether people accept it or not, whether people want to receive his sacrifice, that God died on their behalf so that they would have a chance to come back to him. We're told in verse 6, you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to kill it at twilight. And so we're told that at twilight, you know, probably around 5 or 6 o'clock, they were to kill the animal. And again, this was symbolic of what Christ would do thousands of years later. That God would send his perfect sacrifice to come and die on our behalf. We're told in Romans 6, verse 23, for the wages of sin is death, but the free gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus our Lord. You know, the Bible teaches that we are under a sentence of judgment in the same way that Egypt was under a sentence of judgment. You know, some people fool themselves into thinking that if I just try to be a really good person, if I just like try to outweigh my bad deeds with my good deeds in this life, you know, maybe then God will accept me. But according to God, we are guilty and we're standing under his punishment. And it's only by what he provides that we can be saved. Well, we're told in verse 7, moreover, they shall take some of the blood and put it on the doorpost and on the lintel of the house in which they eat it. So they're to take some of this blood and put it on the doorway, which is kind of strange. But, you know, a lot of people wonder, like, well, what's up with Christians and the blood? They're always talking about the blood. It's such a gruesome religion. But the blood was symbolic of life. You know, when an ancient person watched an animal sitting there bleeding to death, they noticed that when the blood would run out of the animal, the life would run out with it. And so blood and life were associated together. And so the blood indicated that a life had been taken. And we're told later in verse 13, the blood should be a sign for you in the houses where you live. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you and no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike down the land of Egypt. And so apparently each household was to take some of this blood, take a hyssop branch and sort of smother it on the door. And when the angel of death came to judge the household and take all of the firstborn of, or the firstborn of each household, it would see that an innocent sacrifice or substitute had been taken and they would pass over that household. And that's actually where we get the word Passover from. We're told in 1 Peter 1, verse 18, that you were not redeemed with perishable things, but with the precious blood as of a lamb, unblemished and spotless, the blood of Christ. And so God says that the only way for you to get right with me is through the way that I specify. And that's through my son, Jesus, the unblemished lamb. Then we're told in verse 14, now this day will be a memorial to you and you shall celebrate it as to the feast of the Lord. Throughout your generations, you're to celebrate it as a permanent ordinance. And so the Israelites were to celebrate this, you know, Passover feast year after year throughout their generations. 1,400 years pass from this event. And in the first century AD, we're told that Jesus died on the Passover. And then we're told that it happened right around twilight. And so by this time, it was actually customary for the priests in the temple to take a lamb for the nation on Passover and to slaughter it at dusk. Most commentators think that as Jesus was hanging on the cross and gave up his last breath, that at that very moment, the high priest was taking the lamb and killing it. And so thus, Jesus was fulfilling the Passover symbolism. It's really an incredible picture of what God would do. An incredible picture of what God would do for us. Now, what does this story or this part of Moses' life tell us about faith? First of all, Moses put his faith in God's unusual plan of salvation. Quite unusual. Think about it. I mean, we're so familiar with this story that we sort of lose how odd this would be. God's like, okay, the last plague, I'm going to take out all of the firstborn males. But any household that decides to have this dinner, they're saved. And I want you to follow every single thing. I want you to make sure that it's an unblemished lamb, no spots. I want you to make sure that there's enough for every household. You know, he just goes through all of these very specific things. And, you know, from Moses' perspective, he must have been thinking to himself, wow, how is this going to save your people? It must have been really weird. You know, Moses was incapable of seeing that his faith would then foreshadow God's plan of salvation through Christ. You know, what he knew was that God had put plagues out on the nation of Egypt, and that he had been faithful in the past. And so he must have reasoned to himself, you know what, I just have to trust what God says here and follow this to the T. And then God's going to save me and my people. Not knowing that this would then become a picture of what would happen in Christ. And so in the same way, we must place our trust in God's unusual plan if we want to be rescued from his judgment. You know, sometimes I'm hit with this question. Okay, so you mean to tell me that God's plan of rescue for the entire human race was to believe in a man who died 2,000 years ago on a cross? Seriously? And God's like, yeah, exactly. It's exactly what I want you to believe. And I think there's a motive behind that. I think that God knows that, for us, we're very prideful. And so he wants to make sure that when we receive his gift, that it's going to be with an attitude of humility. We're told in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 21 through 25, that to the Greeks, the cross is a stumble, or is foolishness. To the Jews, it's a stumbling block. But God, in his wisdom, or in his foolishness, is greater than man's wisdom. So he was trying to demonstrate that, you know, you think you know what's best, but I actually know what's best. Okay, let's look at our last little narrative here in Hebrews 11, verse 29. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land, but when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. And so this is really the climax of the story there in the Exodus, where Moses leads the people out. After the Passover, Pharaoh's like, all right, I had enough, go. And so he leads the people out into this, out into the area moving toward the Sinai Peninsula. Let's read about the account there in Exodus 13, verse 18. Hence God led the people around by the way of the wilderness to the Red Sea. And the sons of Israel went up in martial array from the land of Egypt. Okay. The first thing to notice, you know, is that he says that God moved the people into the wilderness. Now, we're not exactly sure where this area is, but most people think that this is a little bit south of where the Sinai Peninsula and Africa join. And so this was an area that commentators think was between two large mountains. And as the nation of Israel was moving, they stopped when they saw that the Red Sea was there. And behind them were the Egyptians who were following in pursuit because Pharaoh changed his mind. Now, some people have speculated that this Red Sea should be translated the Reed Sea, which is an area that's a little further north by Eilat in Egypt. And they think that there's precedent to think that it should be translated this way. Now, there are a number of problems with this. The first problem is that there's good reason to think that this should actually be translated Red Sea. There's linguistic evidence. The second problem is that in that area, the water during Moses' time would have been about 6 inches deep. Now, we sort of know how the rest of this narrative goes, but that would be kind of ridiculous for an entire army to drown in 6 inches of water. That's like, you know, an entire army of people drowning in, you know, Zumbezi Bay or something like that. No, I think he's talking about the Red Sea. He meant that, which was very deep in that area. Also, that they were in martial array. So they at this point were ready to fight. Then we're told in chapter 14, verse 3, "For Pharaoh will say to the sons of Israel, they are wandering aimlessly in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. Thus I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after them, and I will be honored through Pharaoh and all of his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." And they did so. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his servants had a change of heart toward the people, and they said, "What is this we've done, that we've let Israel go from serving us?" And so the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh. That is, he strengthened his resolve, and Pharaoh chased after the sons of Israel as the sons of Israel were going out boldly. They went out boldly. That is, that they did so in defiance. The NLT says, "With fists raised in defiance." No doubt with a certain finger raised. And so they were going out in defiance of the Pharaoh. Then the Egyptians chased after them with all their horses and chariots, Pharaoh's horsemen and his army, and they overtook them camping by the sea. Word here, overtook, could mean caught up. And so they caught up with the Israelites. And as Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they became very frightened. So the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. But Moses said to the people, "Don't fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians who you have seen today will never see them. You'll never see them again forever." And so he's like, don't be afraid. He calms them down. And the Lord, he says, will fight for you while you keep silent. So he says, don't be afraid. You know, these guys, they were untrained. They were slaves. Most of them probably had, you know, staffs. They didn't know how to fight, whereas Pharaoh's army were well-trained soldiers. He says, stand by and see the salvation of the Lord. So he says, I want you to stand still. And so I think this is also significance. He says, be still, which would have been hard. You know, you're standing there as, you know, thousands of horses are galloping and the earth is quaking. You're standing there still. And God's like, don't move. And I think that that's actually somewhat symbolic. You know, a lot of times God wants us to be still during times of hardship, to trust in him to come through. And he says, the Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. They can't even put out a war cry. They have to sit there and just be quiet and stand still. Can you imagine that? As thousands of people who just want to kill you are rushing toward you. Then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. As for you, lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the sons of Israel will go out in the midst of the sea on dry land. So it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel, and there was a cloud along with darkness, yet it gave light as night. Thus no one would come near, thus the one did not come near to the other all night. So apparently there was this fire, this pillar of fire curtain that separated the Egyptians, when they finally came to the Israelites, separating them so they couldn't get at the Israelites. Now think about the dilemma that they're in. They're pinned between two mountains. They've got these ravenous Egyptians who want to kill them right in front of them. And then they've got this incredible Red Sea right behind them. They're in this impossible situation. And, you know, it must have been a really long night, too. I'm sure that, you know, all night long, the Egyptians were just taunting and be like, oh, boy, just wait until I get you tomorrow. You know, I'm going to get you. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night, and it turned the sea into dry land. So this happened over a course of hours, where Moses stretched out his hand, and we're told that this tunnel started to form in the Red Sea and actually ended up forming into walls. And that the water or the land had dried up. Then the sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on dry land, and the waters were like a wall on them to the right and left hand. Now, you know, this probably required some faith still on the part of Israel. You know, imagine walking through this corridor with, you know, water, walls of water on both sides, 100 feet tall. You know, you'd have to have faith in God that wouldn't come crashing down on you. Then the Egyptians took pursuit, and all of Pharaoh's horses and his chariots and his horsemen went in after him in the midst of the sea. At the morning watch, the Lord looked down at the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire in the cloud and brought the army of the Egyptians into confusion. We're told that they were confused, but Psalm 77 actually elaborates what happens, because we're not given as much detail in Exodus. That when the Red Sea, he says, when the Red Sea saw you, O God, its waters looked up and trembled. The sea quaked at its very depths. The clouds poured down rain. Thunder rumbled in the sky. Your arrows of lightning flashed. Your thunder roared from the whirlwind. The lightning lit up the world. And the earth trembled and shook. I mean, this was a torrential storm. The ground was shaking. There was a whirlwind, lightning flashing. He says, your road led through the sea, your pathway through the mighty waters, a pathway no one knew was there. You led your people along the road like a flock of sheep with Moses and Aaron as their shepherds. And so we're told in verse 25, he caused their chariot wheels to swerve, and he made them drive with difficulty. So the Egyptians said, let's flee from Israel, for the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians. This word swerve means to come off. Means probably that God actually made their wheels lock up as they were pursuing the Israelites. And so Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal state at daybreak while the Egyptians were fleeing right into it. And then the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. You know, you can imagine this incredible scene as the Egyptians are in pursuit in the middle of the Red Sea, following through this corridor. God just lets the waters down, just comes crashing down. Millions of gallons of water crushing the Egyptians. And, you know, they're just booing out all over, many of them dead. And so the waters return and cover the chariots and the horsemen and his entire army. And not even one of them remain. But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea, and the waters were like a wall on them to their left and their right. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. When Israel saw the great power which the Lord used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and his servant Moses. So there you have the narrative. Now, what does this teach us about faith? First of all, Moses put his faith in God's power. That's the most obvious thing that you can see right from the text. And, you know, I think this points to the fact that often God will put us in positions where we can't see a way out. And some of you right now feel like you're in an impossible situation, where you're like, I can't see how God is going to use this. And yet, the example of Moses gives us faith, trust in God that he can, despite the impossible, God can do miraculous things. You know, he often puts us in impossible situations to demonstrate his power. Could be that God has actually led you to this place. You know, for some of us, that means, you know, a situation of suffering. Or where maybe circumstances are just aligning, where it's making it seem like life is just impossible. And yet, God does this oftentimes to demonstrate that he is a powerful and loving God. Okay, let's summarize our findings here. I think the first thing is that Moses lived his entire life in the shadow of the most powerful man on earth. That's what he could see. And yet, he kept his eyes fixed on the only one who is more powerful than Pharaoh. And that's what got him through the suffering and the difficulties that we read about. And the question that I want to ask you tonight is, where are you going to place your trust? Are you going to be like Moses? Are you going to place your faith in God? Or are you going to trust in what you can see? Yeah, I was just talking to a friend the other night, Lord, and we were talking about how if we just really trusted in your sovereignty more, how maybe much more powerful you'd be working in our lives. And that really resonated with me. I think a lot of times my faith is in things that seem like they can happen, whether you're involved or not. And I pray that we can be bold like Moses. Pray that we can have bold faith and trust in you, even in really difficult circumstances. And I pray that we can trust in your power, too, that we can believe that you're a God who promises to work in impossible situations. And so we thank you that we have a relationship with a God like you. And I pray specifically for those of us, Lord, who don't have a relationship with you, that if they sense that you are calling on them to turn to them and receive this Passover lamb that you've provided through your son Jesus, that they would do that and respond to it. And we thank you for anyone who did that in your son's name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.